Israeli treatment of our prisoners. Our message to our inmates is that we will keep supporting them until they are freed. The international community has ignored the issue of Palestinian prisoners for years.
2 weeks ago, six Palestinian inmates caved through a dug hole in the floor of their shared cell, exposing deep security flaws of Israeli system. Palestinians held several rallies calling for ending the Israeli violation of prisoners' rights.
Palestinians will keep holding events like this to voice their support to our detainees in Israeli jails. Israeli regime should know that our prisoners are not alone and we view them as symbol of resistance. The international community should break its silence and expose the true nature of Israeli regime.
Thousands of Palestinians are held in Israeli jails, with hundreds of them under the practice of administrative detention.
Palestinians here stress the rearresting of two inmates who broke out of the Jabal prison does not hide the fragility of the Israeli security system. Palestinians see this cave as a remarkable incident in the history of the Palestinian cause, demanding the international community to stop Israel's torture against detainees. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now, the households of the victims have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
I believe the reason that they did this in front of my eyes and my mother's eyes was to terrorize people. That's what terrorists do.
We have already gotten too late into this legal proceeding. They killed my husband 12 years ago, and I still feel the pain. It's not easy to forget such a great loss. The point is, America and Israel do not feel sorry for this, and that's why we ask Iranian and international judicial systems to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
We are now waiting for the verdict of Iran's Court for International Affairs. We will follow up the case in countries that maintain judicial cooperation with Iran. There, we will demand that U.S. assets be blocked and transferred as compensation to the families of the victims. This is to remind the criminal governments that their crimes will not go unanswered.
Israel has a history of targeted killing of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the assassinations, its footsteps can be traced in all of the incidents. In this video, recorded in 2018, ex-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Less than 2 years after this comment, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was a key Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Over the years, different American and Israeli officials have spoken openly about, quote, taking down the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry. The plaintiffs here say the U.S. was trying to do so by killing Iranian nuclear scientists, and today by enforcing the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. But they say both measures have so far failed, and the West is now urging Iran to sit and talk about its nuclear program in Vienna to revive the 2015 nuclear pact.
Plaintiffs here hope that their lawsuit against the U.S. will break the chain of Washington's targeting of the Iranian scientific community. But they say the underlying messages are even more important, as the case lays bare the U.S.'s double standards with regards to human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In many cities in France, anti-health pass protesters marched again in what has become a weekly protest. They do not agree with the mandatory measures the French government has established to obtain much more vaccinations. But the protest movement is weakening a bit. Important figures of the Yellow Vests want to re-engage with the original inquiries of the movement, more social justice and against the authoritarian policy of the government. They want to elaborate a political force that will be able to influence the 2022 presidential elections.
Today we are with the angry citizens against the health pass, but as the Yellow Vest movement, we continue demanding more social justice and less taxes and a participative democracy.
70% of the French have received two jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. Due to the health pass that people have to show in almost every public places, the virus is soon to be under control and life in France is slowly returning back to normal. The National Institute on Economic Studies, INSEE, announced that the French gross domestic product, GDP, will increase with more than 6% in 2021, after a fall last year of 10%. This is good news for the economy, except that workers' rights are deeply affected by the COVID crisis. More and more people lose their full-time contract, which is often transformed in variable working hours and a temporary contract, less paid and most of all, offering less job security.
I am a volunteer worker. I see the misery. We distribute food. There is much more misery now and more young people are in need.
During the lockdown, people with precarious contracts were affected the most. Today, the government of Macron is reforming the unemployment status. He makes the labor market very flexible. He takes advantage of this crisis to implement his antisocial policy.
French President Macron had once declared that an unemployed person just has to cross the street to find a job. For many people, this is only wishful thinking. The vaccination campaign is certainly successful in pushing back the COVID virus and putting the economy back on track. But the French population remains deeply divided about the mandatory health pass. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
In the limelight.
In Nigeria, the revered Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki following his recent release after an illegally prolonged detention of over 5 years is again active on the social scene. He has restarted his lectures that over the past decades have changed the face of the northern parts of Africa's most populous country by guiding at least 14 million people to the enlightened path of the Ahlul Bayt, or the blessed household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff. This article is published under the heading, Sheikh Zakzaki's Spirit of Resistance Back on Nigerian Social Scene. Stay tuned for more. Freedom, its flag bearers, and the resolve to cater to the needs of the society can never be suppressed in any part of the world, despite the most inhuman measures used against them by the traffickers of terrorism. This is the lesson humanity has learned from the epic sacrifice of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, whose martyrdom has continued to inspire the seekers of freedom and justice in every era and in every place. In our own times, there are many vivid examples of how Karbala has infused the spirit of freedom and resistance and the quest for justice in contemporary communities, the prime example being the Islamic Republic of Iran, which for the past 42 years has continued to defeat whatever satanic plots the United States and its agents have come up with. The message from Iran today is evident all around, from Afghanistan to the Levant, and to Latin America and West Africa, where American-sponsored terrorism has failed. In Nigeria, the revered Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, following his recent release after an illegally prolonged detention of over 5 years, is again active on the social scene. He has restarted his lectures that over the past decades have changed the face of the northern parts of Africa's most populous country by guiding at least 14 million people to the enlightened path of the Ahlul Bayt, or the blessed household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. This had horrified the regime of Muhammadu Buhari, a former general with a bloody record of military coup and seizure of power in 1980s, and who now, despite being an elected president, does not hesitate in taking orders from the world's most notorious terrorist regimes, such as the Zionists and the Wahhabis, to suppress freedom and justice in Nigeria. Sheikh Zakzaki, his most prominent victim, whose sons were killed by the Nigerian military during its terrorist attack on the town of Zaria and the massacre of over 1,000 men, women, and children on 15th December 2015 during a peaceful religious gathering, is possessed with an indomitable spirit that never broke down during the 5.5 years of torturous imprisonment he and his wife went through, even deprived of medical treatment for their ailments. Last Sunday on September 19th, in Abuja, several families of martyrs of the military's December 2015 massacre met with the leader of the Islamic Movement, IMN, who consoled them for the losses of their loved ones and urged them to always remember the persecution and hardships suffered by Imam Hussein, peace upon him, at the hands of the army of the Umayyad tyrant Yazid that besieged and massacred them in Karbala in 61 AH. He told the bereaved families that no sacrifice is too high when it comes to the path of Allah, adding, "We are proud of carrying bullet fragments in our bodies, and this is proof of our spirit of resistance and refusal to yield to tyranny." Among the visitors was Dr. Isa Waziri Guantu, who said he lost 4 of his children during the Zaria massacre, but is determined to follow the right path championed by Sheikh Zakzaki. Another visitor was Hajia Jumei Karofi, who lost 5 children. The proud mother said, "I would like the killers of my children to know that what they did to them would never scare us away from Sheikh Zakzaki and the Islamic Movement in Nigeria. In fact, they are ready to pay the ultimate sacrifice in defense of Islam." It is still not too late for President Buhari to atone for his atrocities against the Nigerian Muslims by apologizing to Sheikh Zakzaki and the bereaved families whose members his army had brutally massacred. Islam is a religion of repentance and forgiveness, and the sooner he does, the better for him, in order to weed out repression and injustice from Nigeria. No matter what the Israelis, the Saudis, the Americans, and all other traffickers of terrorism think.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked and
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
Hello,
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam, Mir Baghiri, about the Master of the Martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Please stay tuned.
چندین روایت در باب پیاده روی و مشی در زیارت سید الشهدا علیه السلام هست.
There are some beautiful narrations regarding visiting the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on feet in authentic resources. Now, the path that we take to visit the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is the path towards Allah. So from the very beginning, rewards are counted for the visitors to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala. One important narration is recorded in Tahzib by Shaykh al-Tusi, in Sawab al-A'mal by the late Shaykh al-Saduq, and even in Kamil al-Ziyarat.
قال ابو عبد الله علیه السلام فرمودن انه من خرج من منزله اگر کسی از منزل خودش خارج بشه.
In this narration ابن ابی فاخته quotes امام جعفر الصادق علیه السلام saying whoever leaves his house in order to visit the tomb of امام الحسین علیه السلام in every step that he takes on his path there is reward from Allah. Also, with every step that he takes, one of his sins will be removed from his book of deeds. When the visitor reaches the shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Allah counts him or her as those who find salvation and safety. From this narration, we find how important the visit to the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is, especially for those who do this visit on feet towards the city of Karbala. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mir Baghiri. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
August 26th, a bombing outside Kabul International Airport killed scores of Afghans, as well as 13 American troops, as Afghan and foreign nationals rushed to leave the country. The incident marked the deadliest attack for U.S. troops in Afghanistan in over a decade, as Washington was wrapping up its evacuation operation. Daesh terror group claimed responsibility for the bombing. Later, on August 29th, in one of the final acts of the U.S. military in Afghanistan before ending its 20-year war in the country, Washington launched a deadly drone strike in Kabul. In what the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, called a righteous strike, the Pentagon claimed it targeted a position of Daesh terrorists in retaliation for the bombing of the Kabul airport and killed at least one Daesh facilitator. However, on Friday, a U.S. Central Command investigation found that the drone strike killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, and not any Daesh terrorists.
It is further my assessment that the strike team were convinced at the time of the strike that the area was clear of civilians, and that they had taken prudent steps in regards to weaponizing the strike to minimize the potential for civilian casualties. Finally, it is my assessment that they did believe, as reported, that there was a secondary explosion. Our investigation now concludes that the strike was a tragic mistake.
General McKenzie said the U.S. intelligence had reasonable certainty that the suspected location was a Daesh position where terrorists were planning an attack on Kabul airport. The U.S. intelligence tracked an aid worker's vehicle, assuming it was linked to Daesh. They mistakenly thought the car was loaded with explosives, while it had only containers of water. In a statement, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin admitted that the strike led to tragic death of innocent civilians and called it a horrible mistake. The catastrophic consequences of the U.S. intelligence miscalculations have exposed the human cost of war that had been fought largely from the air for years. That will fuel the criticism of the Biden administration's Afghanistan policy and chaotic withdrawal of American troops from the country after 20 years of war. For the past two decades, Afghanistan has been a scene of a devastating conflict. The U.S. military conducted thousands of drone strikes, killing hundreds of civilians and children.
Yes, I think that last drone strike, unfortunately, is symbolic of 20 years of killing Afghans, of destruction, and of government lies. We were told so many times in the United States that the U.S. was winning when the Taliban was taking over more and more territory. And we were told that the drone strikes are very precise and they just take out the, quote, bad guys. And so when this last drone strike happened and it killed an entire family, after the U.S. military had said it took out somebody who was an extremist, who was about to blow people up at the airport, we have to start wondering about all of the strikes that have taken place.
The U.S. military has admitted it killed 10 innocent Afghan civilians and targeted the wrong vehicle in a drone strike in Kabul on August 29th. Now, Washington is facing a double whammy of mounting pressure from inside and outside the country over the handling of the withdrawal operation, as well as the failure of U.S. intelligence. The fact that this horrible mistake was made as the U.S. troops ended their 20-year occupation will make the shambolic U.S. withdrawal even worse. The Pentagon initially defended the attack on Kabul, stressing that it killed Daesh operatives despite media reports of civilian casualties. However, with Afghanistan being under global scrutiny, the U.S. had no choice but to admit to its failure. International humanitarian organizations have called for prosecuting those suspected of criminal responsibility in the act.
Sometimes I think the intelligence is just bad, like the fact that they couldn't predict that the Taliban was ready to take over Kabul. Sometimes I think the military just doesn't care if it kills a lot of civilians and pretends that it was militants who were killed. They figure who's going to go and do the reporting, because a lot of times it's in remote areas that is very difficult for reporters to get to. And sometimes I think they use the intelligence, or they manipulate the intelligence for their own ends. For example, in the case of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there was certainly a manipulation of the intelligence to tell the American public and the world that there were weapons of mass destruction when there weren't.
That's why the U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Syria, Iraq, and Somalia, out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility, while destroying the lives of civilians. On August 15th, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau dissolved the parliament and called a snap election. Now, Canadians are preparing to cast their ballot in the 2021 federal election on September 20th to elect members of the 44th Canadian Parliament. Polls show that the Liberal Party, led by the current Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and the Conservatives, led by leader Erin O'Toole, are neck and neck in the race, as they are both predicted to win 32% of the national popular vote. Therefore, it is a type of election where Canadian Muslim voter groups can make a difference, as they account for 3.2% of the country's population. Muslims are mainly concerned about Islamophobia. Canada has suffered from more mass killings motivated by Islamophobia in the last 5 years than any other country in the G7. Since 2017, 11 Canadian Muslims have been killed in 3 deadly attacks driven by Islamophobia. The 2017 Quebec City mosque mass killing is one example, which has been the worst anti-Muslim mass murder incident in Canadian history.
Well, it's certainly out of character for most Canadians, but there is a right-wing segment of Canadian society that has gained legitimacy from the actions and words of U.S. President Donald Trump. So the Conservative Party has generally been sort of very pro-Israeli, anti-Muslim, and anti-Palestinian, and has attacked people who have expressed support for the Palestinians, claiming that they're somehow anti-Semitic.
Islamophobia is a problem deeply rooted in Canada's social and political fabric. Experts believe that the federal leaders lack what is needed to fully address the rise of hatred and systematic discrimination in this country. According to one victim, the political leadership is responsible for allowing this polarization to take place, and the years of public discourse have created this anti-Muslim hate. The Liberal Party of Canada has vowed to create a national support fund to help survivors of hate crimes. It also wants to update the federal anti-racism strategy by 2022 and approve new legislation to combat this spread of online hate. Meanwhile, the New Democratic Party and the Conservative Party have promised to tackle online hate as well. However, there is no mention of Islamophobia or racism in the major political party's entire platform. During their campaign trail, none of the Canadian major political parties held public events to address racism and Islamophobia. Also, despite all having platform planks on the issue, when questioned, none of them explained why they haven't done that.
Trudeau was always balanced and kept a Canada independent policy. His son Justin actually has been very fair and supportive of the Muslim community, even though he has been attacked by right-wing members of the politics and also in the media. So he has actually taken some flack for taking stance in support of the Muslim community, but he has not been able to make the change for Israel, where he's so anti-Palestinian and so very much beholden to the pro-Zionist lobby in Canada.
Canadian Muslims urged their leaders to take measures to combat Islamophobia, as it has resulted in deadly attacks and rising anti-Muslim hatred. However, Canadian politicians have for years failed to do so, since they see Muslims as only potential vote-getting opportunities that belong on their platforms.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has approved documents for Iran's full membership at the Eurasian Political, Economic, and Security Alliance. The decision came as the 21st summit of the organization opened in Dushanbe earlier in the day. The Islamic Republic joined the SCO in 2005 as an observer state.
SCO, with the current membership, covers close to 50% of the world population and about one-third of the world's GDP. Being a member of this organization will take a lot of pressure away in terms of Western sanctions, Western impositions, monetary manipulations via the US dollar as a remedy for payment. No more.
Leaders from 8 member states and 4 observer states attended the annual summit in Tajikistan's capital on Friday, with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping addressing it virtually along with Russian president. Xi criticized sanctions imposed on world economic exchanges, urging the SCO members to stay united against attacks by other countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his counterparts from Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan attended in person. Addressing the summit, President Raisi said the world today has entered a new era when hegemony and unilateralism are declining.
The world is entering a new era with a new order. Domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
The Iranian president also underlined that sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. In his address at the SCO summit, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi described sanctions as economic terrorism and the hegemonic power's most important tool to impose their own will on the others. He warned that unilateral sanctions are not limited to one country, but as it has become clear in recent years, they include more independent countries, particularly the SCO member states. 2 key members of the alliance, Russia and China, have also come under sanctions from the West. Ties between Washington and Beijing deteriorated after former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in 2017, waging an economic war against China. While many expected the current administration of Joe Biden to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies, it adopted a tougher stance against China and Russia, imposing several rounds of sanctions on them on various pretexts.
Western trade currency restrictions do not exist in the SCO member countries. This will drastically reduce the potential for Western sanctions and will increase, on the other hand, Iran's potential to deal with the East, for example, or especially China and Russia, entering partnership agreements with these and other SCO countries, benefiting from comparative advantages.
At the end of the summit,
SCO member states signed the Dushanbe Declaration, in which they stress a position to interference under the excuse of counterterrorism or human rights, or solving key international and regional issues through small cliques, ideology, or confrontation mentality. They also agreed on strengthening cooperation in cracking down on terrorism, extremism, and separatism, and reached a consensus in supporting building an inclusive government in Afghanistan.
The Israel regime has reportedly started a cyber sabotage campaign in the UAE to interfere with the regional air and maritime navigation in West Asia.
Cyber warfare is becoming more and more important and more dangerous as well. So Israel wants to take advantage of any opportunities there.
The campaign seeks to disrupt the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman region's air and maritime navigation systems, thus destabilizing the regional security situation. On the other hand, the bid seeks to transit the focal point of crisis away from the occupied territories towards the region, and therefore reduce the political and security pressure faced by the regime's ruling body. The UAE has signed dozens of memorandums of understanding with Israel since it became the first Arab state to normalize ties with Israel this century.
Israel sees itself with the Sunni monarchies and the conservatives as their potential allies in this. So it wants to be able to conduct the kind of cyber sabotage and infiltration that is becoming so important, so much more important. So it's not surprising that they would do this when they have the opportunity, and the UAE is providing that opportunity for them.
Israel has said that it expects $1 billion in trade with the UAE by the end of 2021, and $3 billion in 3 years. The UAE aims to raise the value of economic activity with Israel to more than $1 trillion in the next 10 years. According to regional observers, at the heart of the UAE's desire to normalize ties with the regime in Tel Aviv was its penchant for U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets, which the peace deals with Israel, known as the Abraham Accords, made possible. To the Persian Gulf state, established full diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime, in a deal brokered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. Shortly after the deal was reached, the Trump administration authorized the sale of 50 advanced F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. The UAE and Israel are reportedly deepening their ties and espionage activities in the region. The UAE has helped Israel set up a center for military and maritime reconnaissance on the strategic Yemeni island of Socotra. The Red Crescent Society of the United Arab Emirates has signed a contract with the Tel Aviv regime in order to create an intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at Socotra Airport. Socotra is home to some 60,000 people. It overlooks the Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route that connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. It also has a unique ecosystem, which is already being exploited by the Emirates. The mission reportedly aimed at collecting information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab el-Mandab and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE. Socotra has been a source of tensions between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. They have been jockeying for position for control of the island's unique resources in the absence of a powerful government in Yemen amid a ferocious war on the country. Back in June 2020, UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra.
As you know, Israel has always welcomed the opportunity to have alliances within what it has considered to be the enemy camp, namely the Arabs. And in the opportunity with an alliance is to profit in various ways, to build one's power through espionage.
The light.
From Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted an art show themed with Aspiration for Peace. Organized by the Economic Cooperation Organization, the event seeks to shed light on the beauty of a global peace through the language of art. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Each one of these delicate works of art are created by an artist from a different country, each trying a unique way to highlight the need for lasting peace in the world. Dubbed Aspiration for Peace, the art gallery is organized by Echo Cultural Institute with the aim of promoting global peace through the language of art.
By holding this event, we want to send a message of peace to all countries. We invited diplomats from all embassies here to gather and unite and celebrate a peaceful gathering. Also, the artworks showcased here are created by artists from various countries, and this represents how beautiful it is for nations to live peacefully.
Art helps connect different civilizations and nations. It helps us bridge the cultural gaps and find commonalities. This will establish mutual understanding and harmony among nations, and therefore conflicts can be avoided.
In some of the artworks, images immediately communicate with the audience, even if faces are veiled. These pictures try to narrate the story of Afghan women and an uncertain future that they're facing amid the Taliban's takeover of power in Afghanistan.
The events that are taking place in my country, Afghanistan, are so painful. It might take hours to tell you how hard it is for an Afghan girl to live in insecurity and uncertainty. But through the language of art, you can understand all these words without the need for translation.
The art show was held on the occasion of the International Day of Peace. Observed every year on September 21st, the occasion was introduced by the UN General Assembly as a chance to strengthen the ideals of peace through observing 24 hours of nonviolence and ceasefire.
A picture is worth a thousand words, and indeed, no words can be as strong as the strokes of an artist in speaking the beauty of peace. And this is how the universal language of art transcends the political and cultural boundaries and touches the hearts of viewers, no matter what language they speak. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
French slackliner has wowed watching crowds in Paris by crossing from the Eiffel Tower to the other side of the River Seine. Nathan Poulenc walked across a rope suspended 17 meters above the ground. He finished the 600-meter course in half an hour. On one point, he sat and lay on the rope before arriving at his destination, the Chaillot Theatre. The 27-year-old daredevil practiced 4 years to perform this show. Poulenc said that he was staying focused during the walk, and that was very challenging.
When I was young, I had fear of heights, and I learned to contain it. During the performance, I really didn't feel it. I really didn't have that problem. I felt some stress over starting it, but no vertigo, no.
Poulenc said that it was an uneasy experience, but he was happy to share it with the public. The athlete started slacklining 10 years ago. In 2019, he performed a 510-meter-long walk between two skyscrapers in Paris.
SpaceX's first all-private crew have successfully concluded the first orbital mission in history with no professional astronauts on board. The four tourists on board the SpaceX Dragon capsule landed in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Florida after spending 3 days in space. The capsule was then transported by helicopter to the Kennedy Space Center, where on Wednesday they took off aboard. During the flight, the crew members' vital signs were monitored to study the effects of the environment of space on complete novices. The Inspiration 4 mission was an effort aimed at encouraging the democratization of space. It sought to prove that the cosmos are accessible to crew that have not been handpicked nor been in training for years. Iceland is not unfamiliar with volcanoes, but one that has gone on for more than 6 months is surprising even for the volcanic Scandinavian nation. Hot lava has been spewing out of craters near Iceland's capital, Reykjavik, since March 19th. Scientists say there is no sign that the eruptions will end anytime soon. Almost 143 million cubic meters of lava has been discharged so far, creating spectacular scenes. More than 300,000 people have visited the site of the eruptions. The field has been named the Beautiful Valley of Lava. Visitors and keepers of a zoo in the Peruvian capital, Lima, are thrilled over the birth of 8 baby penguins from the vulnerable Humboldt species. Zookeepers say the chicks were hatched in July and they're expecting 6 more additions later in October. Currently, the newborns spend their days resting in their nests and being fed by their parents. The Huachipa Zoo currently has 42 Humboldt penguins and is working on recovering the species population.
We have 8 2-month-old chicks and 6 eggs. In 42 days, those eggs will hatch and the chicks will come out. The important thing about Humboldt penguins is that we are recovering their population because they are in a vulnerable state. We are increasing their populations with the breeding we are doing in the zoo.
Researchers say a maximum of less than 10,000 Humboldt penguins are left in the wild, with their population size undergoing extreme fluctuations. The species face emerging threats from agricultural activities to their own vulnerability to predators. The Humboldt penguins are only found along the Pacific coast of Chile and Peru and are enlisted as threatened species by the International Union for Conservation of Nature.
A passionate Indian teacher has turned a road into a classroom and houses walls into blackboards to make up for the prolonged school shutdown caused by COVID-19. Deep Narayan Nayak is working with nearly 60 students in a small tribal village in the eastern state of West Bengal. He started to teach students, most of whom are first-generation learners, last year, when all local schools closed under lockdown restrictions. Nayak says that he was worried about his students' education since many of them did not have access to smartphones or internet connection. But thanks to his initiative, his students can learn everything from popular nursery rhymes to the importance of masks.
We are teaching children everything, how to maintain social distancing, how to wear a mask, what is the importance of masks and hand washing. The children came forward and participated in this initiative, and they are also educating others.
The parents and villagers are grateful to Nayak, saying that they are happy their children are no longer wasting their time loitering around in the village. Nayak is now popularly known as the teacher of the street among the villagers. Water scarcity is a significant and accelerating problem for people worldwide. A UK-based charity, WaterAid, has installed life-size ice sculptures in London to show the fragility of water and the threat posed by climate change.
Climate change is water change, so it means that droughts will get longer, which means that previous reliable sources of the water just won't be there. It means that flooding, sometimes in the same country, becomes very severe, polluting water sources and destroying infrastructure. But it also means unpredictability. Water sources that people have relied on for generations, for farming as well as for their health and hygiene, are just no longer there.
Farr, a policy analyst for WaterAid, said people with no access to clean water are bearing the brunt of climate change. The sculptures opposite Tower Bridge are part of the charity's fight, which calls on the British government to increase funding for climate adaptation. The sculptures show how clean water is essential for human survival, with some being depicted carrying buckets and pots in search of water. The environmental group wanted to highlight the threat climate change poses to our planet.
Egyptian archaeologists have completed the renovation of a tomb of an ancient king, providing a rare glimpse into the world's oldest known pyramid. The 4,700-year-old Step Pyramid was built during the reign of King Djoser. The southern tomb is the second for the king, and it is smaller compared to royal tombs. Some researchers suggest it was built for the preservation of Djoser's internal organs, while others say it was built symbolically. It had been undergoing renovation for 15 years before being reopened to the public.
120 tons of blocks were raised by Egyptian hands, astonishingly, and with the determination to achieve one goal. That is the reconstruction of the tomb, just as it was 4,700 years ago.
The complex is historically significant, as it is the earliest known example of the Egyptian custom of pharaohs being buried in pyramid-shaped tombs. According to experts, ancient Egyptians believed that this step design served as a gigantic stairway of the soul of a deceased pharaoh that could ascend to the heavens. Now, we've all grown up playing with a pinball machine at least once in our lifetime. Now, a free runner has designed a giant scaled-up pinball machine, turning it into his personal playground. Latvian free runner Paša Petkuns came up with the idea of playing on real-life pinball machines during a road trip. The set, made in London, is not for the faint-hearted, as it is slanted at a 45-degree angle. Paša thought his breakdancing experience might help, but in the end, he had to invent a whole new style of movement. The producer of the film, showing the performance on the machine, described the set as very scary.
It's 17 meters high, it's 16 meters wide, and 20 meters long. It's an angle of 45 degrees, and I don't know if you understand how much 45 degrees is. It's like, it's a double black diamond slope. It's something you don't go down, you can't, because it's more like falling than anything else.
It does sound scary. Now, the impressive set, designed to look like a retro pinball machine you might find in arcades, took 7 weeks to construct. Global landmarks like the Eiffel Tower and the Statue of Liberty are featured in it. Petkuns works as a Hollywood stunt double.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Plastic pollution has become one of the most pressing environmental issues, as disposable products overwhelm the world's ability to deal with them. But a young Spanish designer is dedicating his time to the cause of recycling plastic waste. 28-year-old Humberto Les quit his job last year to focus full-time on his environmental efforts. He collects trash from the coast of his home island of Gran Canaria. Humberto usually picks up an average of 5 kilos from the shore at a time. After he is done compiling, he processes the material and turns it into pieces of furniture. Humberto's aim is to make the task of recycling plastic economically justifiable, that is.
I decided to leave my job, stability, to come back here to develop a project to clean the coastline by designing furniture, because I realized that the coast could not be cleaned in an altruistic manner. So I found a way to give economic value to the waste found in the coast.
Humberto is making products ranging from clothes hangers to stools, but he also wants to create larger products with a longer lifespan in the future. According to the UN Environment Programme, only 9% of all plastic waste produced throughout history has ever been reprocessed. Around 80% of it remains accumulated in dumps, landfills, or nature.
floating concert venue has entertained music lovers in London. Renowned pianist Masayuki Tayama and his partner started a project to play on a canal boat traversing the city's waterways 2 months ago. Since then, they have performed 9 concerts, and their upcoming performances are already sold out in months ahead. The couple came up with the idea after living on a narrow boat with a digital piano.
This is the piano boat, which is the only canal boat of its kind. It was built to our specifications as a floating concert venue. So we have a brand new Steinway grand piano, and here we give musical experiences for people on the canals.
The artists believe the experience is very different from playing in regular concert halls. They say recitals on the boat create a unique interaction with the audience and it feels friendlier. Small fairy pigeon Vader has interrupted a cricket match in Ireland. A playful puppy ran into the field of a semi-final match and caught the ball. The scene caused laughter amongst those present. After a few minutes of chasing the dog, players managed to get the ball back. The funny video has gone viral on the internet.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.